Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Testing season is here, and you know what that means. A number two pencil and a lot of bubbles to fill in as Massachusetts schools administer the MCAS and a new test called PARC.
But imagine if, instead of sitting kids down to choose synonyms or answer questions about a small reading passage, you could test them in more meaningful and useful ways. For example, imagine if you could find out how proficient they are at conversation or at collaborating or assess their sense of well-being.
These are among the suggestions from Susan Engel, a Williams College developmental psychologist. She argues that standardized tests only measure a kid's ability to do well on standardized tests. She says no one has publicly questioned a fundamental assumption about those tests, that they measure something meaningful or predict something significant.
Susan Engel lays out a lot of this in two recent books. One of them is called The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools. And the other is called The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood. And Susan Engel joins us now from Williams College in Northwestern Massachusetts to talk about her ideas. And welcome, Susan Engel, to Radio Boston. It's good to have you.
Thanks so much. Delighted to talk to you.
And we want to hear from our listeners on this, whether you're a teacher, a parent, or a student yourself preparing to sit down for some of those tests. Do you think schools are measuring the right skill sets? Do you think schools need to rethink not only how they test, but what skills they emphasize in the classroom? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're also on Facebook and Twitter and Radio Boston. And Susan, I'd love to start with this idea about what we really know about standardized tests. And there's a real debate out there. Should we use them to promote or hold back children, to fire teachers, to withhold funds from school? But as we mentioned in the intro, you say that almost no one has really questioned this fundamental assumption that tests measure something meaningful. What do we really know about tests?
Okay, well, let me start just by something you already said that really interests me, and I think people need to think more about, which is the way in which those tests, the paper and pencil tests that you referred to in the beginning, the way in which we've piled so many different jobs on those tests. Mm. So we want them to tell us which kids are learning what they need to learn. We want them to tell us which teachers are doing a good job. We want them to tell us whether we should fund a school or punish it. And we also want we use those tests to rank kids, to find out who's doing better than the other kid and who's more able, which one should go to Williams and which should not. And actually, those tests, even if they were really good at one of those things, they're probably not good at all of those things. Mm-hmm. And probably no test. I mean, tests are devised for different reasons and should be used for different purposes. And somehow, we've gotten them all mushed up into one kind of inadequate tool. And that brings me to the thing you asked, which is what they predict. So they predict themselves. My students at lunch actually today here at Williams were talking about this with me. You know, if you do well on certain kinds of paper and pencil tests in third grade, all other things being equal, you're likely to do very well on those same tests in eighth grade. And in fact, in terms of ranking, if you do better than a certain number of children in the class, the other kids, or you do worse, you're probably going to rank similarly to those other kids a little later on. It's something I talk about a lot in the book, The End of the Rainbow, which is the way in which those tests do and don't predict themselves has to do with things other than testing. Hmm. You know, who read a lot of books when they were a little kid? Who's motivated to do well in school?
So this idea that they predict themselves, this is the idea that they predict that kids are good at doing those tests. But is that not linked to any kind of other predictive qualities?
Well, yeah. So it's not just that. So when people talk about being a good tester, I had a student at lunch saying, you know, well, you just predict, it just tells you whether you're good at taking tests. Well, I would go further than that. I mean, and it fits since I teach here at Williams. We use SATs as part of our admission criteria. It captures a certain core set of academic skills. For instance, how well you do on the SAT has something to do with how big your vocabulary is. That's a big predictor. That has a lot to do with whether you do well on SATs or not. And that predicts other things that are important, how easily you'll learn various kinds of academic material in college. So no wonder that SAT is a good criterion for us here at Williams. If you do well on them, you're likely to read pretty easily when you get here and be able to do sort of answer certain kinds of questions pretty well. So they don't predict they don't predict nothing. That's a bad sentence, but they don't predict nothing. But it's kind of limited. And here's what the tests used in schools tell us very little about: whether once you get out of school, you'll do well in any more meaningful, broader sense. Hmm. Will you be a reader? Will you be someone who knows how to change your mind in the face of evidence? Will you be able to work with others? Those are capacities that actually go far beyond and are far more meaningful once you get out of school. They're even more meaningful in school.
Yeah.
And those are not predicted by any of the paper and pencil tests we use.
And this gets to sort of the next section of this really interesting set of ideas that you put forward. And you wrote about this recently in the Boston Globe magazine, mm-hmm. 7 Things Every Kid Should Master.
Right.
And you propose 7 useful things that should be tested. And it includes reading, which few people would dispute. But you also talk about other skills. And I want to tick through a couple of them for a minute because they're really interesting. Inquiry. You say children are born wanting to find things out.
Right.
But schools, by and large, squelch this impulse. So how do you test? How do you test for inquiry?
Okay, I'm going to just break the rule here and say that one of the things that I think is really fascinating is that I did not start either of those books or any of my research with an interest in testing. And the reason I bring that up is I'm fascinated that people have been so grabbed by that part of what I wrote, because the test is only the end of the story.
I see.
A test should just find out if you did what you set out to do well.
Yeah.
And one of the problems I was trying to correct, especially in the book The End of the Rainbow, I seem to have recreated in terms of the response to the book. That is, I will talk to you. I will answer your question. I am interested in how you test something like inquiry, but I'm even more interested in how you would educate for inquiry. And if you did that well, then the test should be the last chapter of the.
Sure. Well, then my question was this idea that you put out there that by and large this natural impulse that kids have toward inquiry is squelched in school.
Yeah.
So this gets to this idea of how you educate for it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, and you're right, the two are super connected. So in my book, The Hungry Mind, I talk about the emergence of curiosity, and I describe curiosity in infancy and toddlerhood, and everybody listening to the show who has a baby or a grandchild or has even been a babysitter or an older sister or brother knows that you put a baby down in a room of any number of interesting things, books, a donut, an animal, just some furniture, they can't help but find out everything there is to find out in that room. You know, as I say, babies are like one-person wrecking crews. And what looks like wrecking to a mom or a babysitter is actually inquiry. They're trying to find out what's around them. And they're going beyond that. They want to find out why things do the things they do. Why does it topple over when I set it this way and stand up when I set it that way? Why does it not hurt when I hit the wall this way, but hurt and give me a bruise when I hit the wall that way? So babies are born with a great ability to find things out in their environment. That's what developmental and cognitive psychologists have been identifying for years now. And a huge urge to find things out. In fact, their survival depends on it. So cognitive development, how our minds grow, is by figuring out why things are different than we thought they would be, and then getting a new idea about how things are. So they're natural scientists.
Right.
They're natural experimenters.
And how do schools squelch that?
So, yeah, that's the sad part of the story, and that's the middle part of that book. When you look at, and I describe the research in the book, when you look at kids who are about 3, and again, everybody in the audience will know this who's been around a 3-year-old, they can't stop asking questions.
Right.
It's not just that they tinker and meddle, they ask a million questions. And so they are intrepid explorers in that sense. Once they get to school, at least the way our schools are structured, very often there's no time or opportunity for the kind of investigating, tinkering, and question asking that seems so important to them when they're younger and such powerful tools for learning. So, and this is where the testing part of this story comes in. If teachers are so pressured to teach very specific things that are going to show up on tests, they have very little opportunity. They're given very little leeway to help kids pursue the kinds of things that interest them, the things they want to find out. And in my research, which I describe actually in both books, you see this again and again. It's not about mean teachers versus nice teachers. It's not about skilled teachers versus novice teachers. No matter what, when teachers feel that they're pressured to push certain kinds of information or very specific limited skills, they just can't afford to say to a kid, you know, great, let's find that out, or let me think about that question.
Right, they've got to stay on track and get ready for the next test.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, so you advocate, this more, I mean, I hope it's okay that I use this word, but a kind of softer testing regime. That is, you want to test kids for this sense of inquiry, flexible thinking, use of evidence, conversation, the ability to collaborate.
Yeah.
These all sound like really important skills, but how do you test for that stuff?
Okay, so again, I'm going to break the rule. It's okay that you use the word softer, but I disagree with it. And you're not alone.
Yeah.
I just had a conversation with someone, a really interesting guy in a foundation the other day, who talked about how important it was for schools to begin to measure the soft skills.
Yeah.
So you could either be measuring the soft skills or you could use a softer method of measurement. But I think that's a mistake because I don't think there's any evidence that getting a kid's answers on a piece of paper is harder, if that means firmer, more revealing, more reliable, more informative than some other measure. So I personally reject the soft, hard dimension in this domain because I think it misleads people. Just because you put something into a number and you say he got a 640 or a 1280 doesn't actually mean it tells you anything more useful or more reliable.
Mm.
So
But let me just stop you there, because doesn't it mean, I mean, in some cases, and here's where some of the pushback might come to your ideas, and that is, and I'll use the word again, sort of harder or crisper standardized testing that sort of puts a number on, you know, the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic, and really gets a sense of what a kid knows. I mean, one of the arguments in favor of this is particularly in some urban school districts that have been historically low performing, that you need a kind of basic metric to make sure that these kids are learning what they need to learn, and that basically if we move away from that kind of testing, schools that primarily cater to Black, Brown, poor people will suffer.
I think it's just the opposite. I think the children in those schools are suffering because they keep coming up short on numbers, or in an effort to get those numbers higher, they're given less than rich, interesting academic experiences. It's something I talk about at length in the book, The End of the Rainbow. The idea that we need one kind of school for children who are poor or in a minority racial group, and another kind of school for kids who are privileged or white, that's a terrible idea in my view. I reject that. Schools are supposed to help all children become thoughtful, become readers, become capable of inquiry or finding things out. All schools should help children learn what it's like to work with others, and I don't see why any child isn't entitled to that kind of educational experience. Now, how you measure it, just to go back to that question.
Sure.
I think that there are very clear, hard, or crisp ways of measuring those things. If you're trying to see whether a school is, let me just give one example. If you want to know whether a school is helping children become capable of real exchange of opinions and information, which after all is essential to a democratic society, we depend on that. So it's easily as valuable as any specific algebra skill or ability to spell, then you look to see if, in fact, conversations are going on in the school. And that's something that we know how to measure. Researchers have been doing that for many years now. How do you do it? You go in, you tape record conversations on a sort of unpredictable random schedule, and then you analyze those conversations in very clear quantitative ways. How many questions were asked? How many answers were given? What kind of vocabulary was used in the conversations? How many kids got to take a turn? Those are very quantifiable measures or quantifiable behaviors. And here's one more piece. Those measure the school and how well it's doing its job. They don't allow you to rank individual children. But what good is it ranking individual children in fourth or eighth grade? Why do we need that?
Yeah, well, some of these ideas are just so interesting and provocative. I love the idea of assessing and measuring a kid's sense of well-being. It seems so essential and so important. And I want to get you to talk a little about that. But we've got a bunch of callers who'd like to get in on this conversation. Okay. Listeners, we're talking to Susan Engel. She's a Williams College developmental psychologist, author of two recent books, The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools, and The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood. What do you think about what she's talking about here, specifically when it comes to testing? Let's go to, 800-423-8255. Let's go to Blake, who's calling from Duxbury. Hi, Blake, you're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Susan. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi,
I'm a middle school principal, and my question is, how do we get, you know, the federal and state legislature to help us move away from the standardized crazy testing that we are just killing our children with?
Oh, my God. I wish I were a better strategist. So my part of this was to try to write a book that described vividly an alternative. I think one of the mistakes that has been made among very like-minded people is to spend too much time sort of moaning and groaning about how terrible the tests are instead of thinking of a good alternative. And that's where this all came from for me. 12 years ago, I got interested in curiosity, and I got interested in it from what teachers were saying to me. And then I thought, okay, if that's what they value, if that's what they think they're encouraging or fostering in their children, let's measure it, because you measure the things you value. So my part in that, Blake, was to try to, instead of criticize what exists, to spend a lot of time focusing on something different. What could we measure? What do we value? What would it look like to hold schools accountable to these other educational outcomes? Having said this, so I think one thing is to build on this idea. I mean, if anybody thinks even part of my idea is reasonable, I want them to start figuring it out. I may not have the right seven capacities, or I may not have been thought of the best ways to measure them, but I want somebody to join the conversation.
Blake, it sounds like you want to join this conversation.
Can I say one other
thing?
Yeah,
please, go ahead. Go ahead.
As a principal, I think the other thing is for schools to try these things out, and some schools are, and they're too worried that if they don't get good test scores 1 year, they're going to perish or fall off the earth. They're not. And if more schools came up with a good alternative to the current standardized tests and came up with ways to educate for those tests, I think they'd be in a very strong position to negotiate with their federal and state government.
But Blake, I'd love to get your response to that, because as a middle school principal in Massachusetts, do you even have that freedom to sort of experiment with different kinds of tests?
Well, I would agree that there is so much pressure on teachers, they literally feel, you know, trapped by coverage, that they just have so much curriculum that they need to cover within, you know, 180 days, that it really does, you know, harm and squash their, you know, freedom and ability to feel free to experiment and investigate and let kids, you know, just be free range, if you will. I know, you know, a lot of school districts, ours as one of them, is really heavily involved in experimenting in what we call project-based learning, which really is, you know, hand in glove of what Susan is talking about. But it is a challenge, definitely, as, you know, we get, you know, a yearly report, and it's important for, I think, all school districts to look good on, you know, a state level.
Blake, I'm really grateful that you called. I'm going to move on because I want to get a couple of other callers on the air. But thank you for calling, and good luck there in your school. Let's go to Kim, who's calling from Newton. Kim, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you so much for raising this conversation and these questions. I'm a mom of three kids, and I think that the education is not caught up with the century and the way the internet is affecting what we need to learn. We no longer need to memorize huge swaths of data. We need to learn how to synthesize the data. We need to learn how to recharge our batteries. And the guy who won the $1 million TED Prize in 2013, I'm forgetting his name, an Indian guy, he talked about
this. Oh, yeah. I knew him.
Yeah, and I feel like the standardized testing is just so last century. It's measuring, I understand we need to have some baseline of vocabulary and math ability, but, you know, my daughter had to stay in one day from school on a Sunday afternoon from playing outside, so she can memorize every river in the United States. And this is not helpful. And she doesn't need to know that. She needs to know how to find that information and synthesize the terabytes of data she's getting every day. So I salute you. I hope you can take this, you know, to schools. And I will say I was in a program like that. I was lucky when I was younger in a gifted program where we were allowed to really do whatever we wanted in terms of inquiry. We were guided how to do it at a very young age, at 8, 9, 10. It's where I discovered my love of etymology and poetry, and it's affected my career choices. And I would have never had that in a regular classroom. So maybe that's one of the models they can look to.
Well, Kim, thanks so much for that call. Susan Engel, our time is running out. I want to conclude with at least one more question. I mean, these are really thoughtful and provocative ideas. There's a lot more callers, by the way, that we're not going to get to, and I'm going to encourage them to put their comments at RadioBoston.org or on Facebook at Radio Boston. But how do we make this a reality in schools? You've put out some really interesting ideas out there. What's the next step?
I guess the next step is to have more conversations like this so that more people begin to think about what an alternative system would look like. Of course, I want everyone to read my book, but I don't know that that's really the next step. And I think to go
might
back
be part
to Blake,
of that next step.
Yeah, but I think the thing to go back to Blake is that more schools have to decide as a group, as a collective, that they're going to ask for an exemption from the test for 1 year, that they're going to do some, or they're going to let the dice fall where they may. Let the kids take the test, see what happens, and meanwhile, they focus on a different set of characteristics or qualities and measure them in the way that they think is most useful. So it's going to take actually some courage and some sort of creative ideas about how to make this happen in specific schools.
Creativity, courage, taking the plunge. Susan Engel is a professor of developmental psychology at Williams College. She's director of the Williams Program in Teaching. She's also the author of The End of the Rainbow, How Educating for Happiness, Not Money, Would Transform Our Schools, and The Hungry Mind, The Origins of Curiosity in Childhood. Susan Engel, thanks so much for putting these ideas on the table. We're really, really grateful to you.
Thanks. Great to talk with you.
Listeners, stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.